for taking the time to give us your input and for being such an active member of CABLE.
For these reasons and many more, your community radio station deserves your support. Stay in tune with your community. Stay tuned to your community radio station. We now return you to Pacifica Radio's live coverage of the Republican National Convention with hosts Mitch Jezerich and Askio Muhammad.
Republican National Convention, Pacifica's national broadcast. I'm Davey D, along with Mitch Jesuit, Askia Muhammad. Thank you for listening. Thank you for tuning in. A whole lot of things are going on. As we are speaking on the floor, Pastor Daryl Scott from the New Spirit Revival Center, who is here in Cleveland, has been speaking. We've been seeing him around. I think we have an interview with him scheduled. But on the phone line with us is Alicia Garza, and we wanted to continue our conversation of Black Lives Matter. Alicia, I want to give you a chance to respond to anything that you heard in the previous hour with Michael Steele, because there was a lot that was being said. But I also want you to be able to share with us the actions that were taking place all over the United States. That might not be in the headlines, but I think they are tremendously important, especially in terms of what we were speaking about this evening.
Certainly. So just to be very clear once again, I think it's important that we take a good, long, hard look at some of the rhetoric that is coming from that side, not just of the aisle, right, but certainly from folks who are really ascribing to a vision that many of us believe is moving us backwards rather than forward. You know, today and tomorrow, there are actions happening all across the country, really raising the issue of the role that police unions play in blocking any kind of meaningful transformation as it relates to police violence and Black communities. I'm actually here right now, right outside of the Police Union Supply Center and Credit Union in Oakland, where there are activists who have chained themselves to the doors. To be clear and to be frank, these organizers, these young Black people, are not chaining themselves to these doors because they have nothing better to do. They're taking time away from their families, from their education, from their jobs, from the people that they love, in order to put their bodies on the line for the futures of our communities. You know, that's the kind of commitment that I think we need to see from elected officials, quite frankly. While there's all kinds of rhetoric being tossed around, both at the convention and through mainstream media channels, what we do know is this. There has been little to no concrete action to save the lives of Black people who are being systematically gunned down at the hands of unaccountable law enforcement. And that is a real problem. And until we're able to solve that problem, I think what we're going to continue to see is not only a real misunderstanding about what this movement is really for, but I think that we'll continue to see a lack of action and a frustration that's growing around a lack of consideration and value for Black lives.
President Obama had convenings at the White House, and Hillary Clinton has stated that she would like to see changes made. And many people, at least at this convention, have associated Black Lives Matter with the Democrats, George Soros, and that sort of thing. You hear that being said all over. Can you clear the air on that? Because it almost sounds like, well, you know, the Black Lives Matter people, they're going to be influencing and making and driving the Democratic Party and this, that, and the third. And I want to know where you all stand on that.
Well, let's be really, really clear. And we've said this many times, but we'll say it again. We're not in support of either party, to be quite frank. Neither party has taken enough action to really call into question the systematic murders of Black people that are happening all across this country. When Hillary Clinton was confronted about her active campaigning for policies and laws that criminalize Black people, she was unwilling to have a conversation. And then, of course, we've seen, you know, protests and all kinds of things happening around the hateful rhetoric from Donald Trump. And so, to be frank, for us, our struggle is not about either political party. We are aligned and committed to our freedom. And we are aligned and committed to the freedom of all people. We want to live in a world where nobody ever has to worry about going to a funeral for somebody who was taken too soon. A loved one, an aunt, an uncle, a community member.
Right.
And to be frank, I just want to say this as well, and I mentioned this earlier in the conversation with Michael. You know, there is a machine that is intent on making sure that it spins hateful stories about a largely peaceful movement. To be frank, it does actually remind me a lot of the attempted takedown of Planned Parenthood. You know, these narratives around us being funded by George Soros or being in the pocket of the Democratic Party, we've been very clear in many arenas. We do not align ourselves with any political party. We have not and will not endorse any candidate from any political party. And certainly, we will continue to fight unapologetically, without strings, for the freedom that we all deserve.
When you hear the type of rhetoric that puts you in the crosshairs in terms of terrorism, and knowing that Black Lives Matter people have been surveilled by the police, and that's been documented, how does that personally make you feel, and what are some of the steps and precautions that you and BLM members are now having to take to not be caught up in something that can really do people harm for their freedom or even their lives?
You know, that's a great question. And to be quite honest with you, for all the talk about Black Lives Matter being a terrorist group, it is our activists and our organizers, even me myself, that have received threats, death threats, threats on our lives, threats on our safety, threats on our family. You know, I've got to be really honest with you. At the end of the day, it's the same people who are throwing around this rhetoric about Black Lives Matter being hateful that are themselves creating a hateful dynamic, and it's really, really unfortunate and blocking progress, to be quite honest with you. And it's meant that we've had to take steps, additional steps, to protect the safety of our activists and our organizers.
Alicia Garza, we appreciate you taking time. I know that you're in front of the police union in Oakland where there's an action. There was actions in Chicago, in New York, and you all have a Freedom Now a campaign that will have actions be taken place in other parts of the country. You know, just so people know, here in Cleveland, which is an open carry state, there were Black people, Black responsible gun owners that said, hey, we can exercise their right to bring rifles here. We saw a number of people do that. And the police union here wanted to have those rights suspended for a week when they saw that there were Black folks willing to do it. So I think the police union thing is something that we should not, dismiss. So we appreciate you taking time out, Alicia Garza from Black Lives Matter. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's coverage of the Republican National Convention from Cleveland, Ohio. That's Davey D with Alicia Garza. I'm Mitch Jezrich, also here with Askia Muhammad. The theme tonight at the convention is Make America First, and there's a lot about foreign policy. In a moment, we're going to have a roundtable about that. Medea Benjamin is here. Lieutenant Ann Wright is here, as well as Phyllis Bennis will be on the telephone. But first, we want to go to the floor. This is Harold Hamm speaking now.
Most strategic geopolitical weapon, crude oil. Despite Obama's attacks, foreign oil have plummeted by 65%. America now has more oil than Saudi Arabia or Russia. We can double U.S. oil production again and put America in a global league of its own. Yeah, let's do it. Donald Trump will restore America's rightful place as the energy leader of the world. Every time we can't drill a well in America, terrorism is being funded. Orlando brought this home once again. You know, it's been 15 years since 9/11. We can't ignore this problem any longer. It's not going away. Climate change isn't our biggest problem. It's Islamic terrorism. Every onerous regulation puts American lives at risk. Developing America's own oil supply is a matter of national security. You know, critics may say I'm just a well-to-do supporter of Donald Trump. They don't know about the 13th child of sharecroppers who was inspired by BOAG teacher Jim Hunter. You know, I couldn't start school before the first snow or Christmas, whichever one came first, because of pulling cotton to feed her family. My first memories are picking cotton barefoot. I'm standing here tonight because the American dream was alive and well when I struck out on my own at 20 years old with nothing but a truck, a cosign note, and a phone.
And that was Harold Hamm speaking from the floor of the Republican National Convention. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's live coverage of the RNC in Cleveland, Ohio. I'm Mitch Jezrich, along with Davey D and Askia Muhammad, and we now have a roundtable. Again, tonight's topic, or the theme for tonight, really, is Make America First Again. It's very much about foreign policy. We'll be going back to the stage again throughout this hour. But now, joining me here at the table are a couple of members we know very well from Code Pink. Retired Colonel Ann Wright is here, as well as Medea Benjamin. It's good to have you both here.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
And also joining us on the phone is Phyllis Bennis. She directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, author a number of books. Her latest is called Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, a Primer. Phyllis Bennis, we thank you for joining us as well.
Great to be with you all.
So Phyllis Bennis, let me begin with you. What's your sense of what you're hearing or what you've been looking at even before this convention from Donald Trump and the Republicans on foreign policy? Do you sense a shift? Do you sense any kind of change?
Well, I think it's very hard to know what Donald Trump's foreign policy is. There's no question he has a wide strip of isolationism running up and down his back or his face or something. And he comes often back to that. But on every specific instance, whether it's ISIS, whatever it is, he goes for the military. So it's a little hard to know exactly what he stands for. When he gave his so-called foreign policy speech, the only speech where he actually talked about foreign policy, it was the first time that he ever actually used notes of any of his speeches. It was clearly not something he was comfortable with, familiar with. The only part of that speech where he talked about actually a course of action, you know, something about what foreign policy should do, was when he talked about, quote, strengthening and promoting Western civilization, as opposed to those who he said were trying to spread universal values that not everyone shares. So there was this sense that, you know, apparently everybody wants to be part of Western civilization. Nobody wants universal values. That means everybody wants to keep America first, get out of NATO, treat allies as international ATMs, forget about negotiations, treat our allies as if they are useless. You know, this is the sort of foreign policy by bumper sticker that we're talking about. The problem is that there's no consistency to actually be able to critique. You can't look at it and say, well, he would do this on the relationship with Saudi Arabia. He would do this on ISIS. He would do this on Israel-Palestine. He would do this on Ukraine, this on China, et cetera, et cetera. There's no actual policies. There's no actual policies. And there's no one that he's brought in who actually has foreign policy expertise that we could say, oh, well, we know what that person stands for, and it's problematic because of XYZ. There is speculation now, and it's incredibly scary, that right-wing Governor Mike Pence, who's now the presumed about-to-be anointed vice presidential candidate, would emerge as the foreign policy guru in a Trump administration. Some people have even compared him to the role that Cheney played with George W. Bush. And if that's true, it's incredibly dangerous, not least because Pence really knows very little about foreign policy. But the fact that he knows very little has not prevented him from playing the role of the hawkishest hawk around. There was an article, a good short piece about him in The Hill in the last couple of days, who mentioned that he had not just supported the war in Iraq, but he was against any kind of a timeline. He said there should be no plans for U.S. troops to come home. He's one of the few people who now continues to claim that ISIS is the result of Barack Obama pulling out the troops in 2011 in an arena where whatever else we don't know about ISIS, what we do know is how and when and where it started, and it was not in 2011. It was 2004 when George Bush had 150,000 U.S. and NATO troops occupying Iraq. That's one of the things we do know. Apparently Mike Pence doesn't know that or isn't prepared to acknowledge it. So the notion that somebody like Mike Pence, who was the first governor to claim that he had the right to prohibit any Syrian refugees from entering his state, something which, of course, he has no right to say, this is a very dangerous portent for what foreign policy might actually look like under Donald Trump.
Again, that is the voice of Phyllis Bennis. She joins us on the telephone as we are here broadcasting from the RNC in Cleveland, Ohio. Again, at the table, we are also joined by Ann Wright and Medea Benjamin. What is your all sense about what's happening here at the convention and what you've heard about foreign policy? I know it's something you both care very much about.
Mitch, first, I think, and it's not patronizing or in any way to salute Code Pink for managing to not only disrupt and having the courage to do that, but to be able to get into the most secure political convention ever on the floor as Republican delegates on two distinct nights, two separate nights. It's like, wow.
Pretty impressive.
I did see someone taking your pictures over there. Was that friendly?
No hate.
What was that friendly? The guy who was taking your picture
over
there?
It happens every single convention, and they keep saying this is the most secure convention ever in the history of the world. And we've heard that 4 years ago and 8 years ago and 12 years ago, and we keep doing it.
Congratulations.
Medea's new name is Houdini. Medea Houdini Benjamin.
Yeah. So now on to your reaction to what you've seen and heard.
Well, first, just following up on what Phyllis said, I think that it's funny standing outside and protesting. There's a lot of Republicans that come up to us and say, but Donald Trump would be the peace president. Certainly it's not Hillary Clinton. And then we agree. We agree Hillary Clinton is not a peace president. But they say to us, well, don't you think that Donald Trump will really get us out of these wars? He's talking about it. And he says NATO is obsolete. And he talks about the countries in the Middle East should take care of their own problems. And we don't want to be nation builders. And then what I say to them, but look at his worldview. Look at how he treats Mexico and how utterly atrocious is his attitude towards even the president of Mexico, and look at how he treats the issue of Islamophobia. I mean, how could you be so Islamophobic and think that you're going to have good relations with the Middle East? So a worldview that is so U.S. a first that is so xenophobic, that is so lacking in compassion, is definitely not a positive worldview. On the one thing I would give him a bit more credit for than Hillary Clinton is on the TPP, the fact that he comes out against the trade deals and that he's made that so much a part of his campaign, whereas Hillary, we know, is doing it just for expediency. I mean, that's an important foreign policy issue. Would he stick to that? I doubt it.
Colonel Wright, the last time we talked, I think I may have asked you this question. If not, let me ask you now. I have heard it said, and I concur with this sentiment, that whatever this conflict is, America can't win it by winning, which is the mentality, we're going to bomb them into the dark ages, we're going to turn their country into a dustbin. That's as if other people don't have some way to retaliate or deal. But my point is, the country cannot win. No one can win this struggle by winning it.
Well, that's right.
And you're a military person.
Yes, 29 years I was in the military, and then 16 years as a U.S. diplomat. And we see over the history that waging wars, military operations, don't resolve things at all. And we start looking back at Vietnam and all the way forward, and particularly in the last 15 years, what have these wars of choice that America has prosecuted, what has resulted? And we see the millions and millions and millions of refugees that we have all over the world. And in fact, I was in Europe in April and visited several different refugee camps, both in Germany and then went down to Greece to meet people who had fled from the violence that the United States had created over these last years. So the use of our military is something that I think we need to be challenging Donald Trump on, as and certainly Hillary Clinton, who is a very likely to use our military rather than continuing on diplomacy. I mean, here she was the chief diplomat. Had I still been in the diplomatic corps, she would have been my boss. And yet she was the proponent for the use of our military in so many different places, and particularly in Libya.
Phyllis Bennis, I want to come back to you. A real flashpoint right now in the world is Turkey. Can you give us a sense of your analysis of what's going on in Turkey, the U.S. relationship to all of this, and do you see a difference between a Democratic or a Republican president in the next year?
You know, it's very hard to know right now. The situation in Turkey is very fluid, very dangerous. What we see in the aftermath of this failed coup attempt has been an effort by the president and the administration of Erdogan to crack down so tightly on civil society. They've gone after about 6,000 generals and top military officials, a bunch of soldiers, but they've also gone after thousands, actually tens of thousands of people in the civil service, in who are teachers, who are journalists, who are lawyers, judges, many of whom have simply been removed from their jobs, but many have been arrested as well. There's now, nobody is quite sure, but it appears to be thousands of people in jail over the last 48 hours. What this is going to mean in the medium term, let alone in the long term, is still a bit unclear. The Turkish government is putting all their focus on the claim that this was put into motion by the Gulen movement, led by the Fethullah Gulen, who's been based for almost 20 years, 16, 17 years, here in the U.S., in Pennsylvania, saying that his movement, which is a very powerful political movement that has, no doubt, made sure to have its own people find positions of power in many different parts of the state apparatus in Turkey, but he's put all the responsibility for the coup on the Gulen movement. We've heard nothing about the question of the Kurds. It's been surprising to some, me among them, that we've heard nothing from Erdogan about Kurdish forces being responsible or taking some revenge against the Kurds. We haven't seen that yet. I'm afraid that will probably come. But what we also haven't heard, there's been sort of conspiracy theories floated about the role of the United States, whether the fact that the U.S. has given sanctuary to Gulen for so many years and that he has been living for so long in the U.S. must mean that the U.S. was somehow behind the coup, which is very unclear. There's no real evidence of that. In fact, one of the things that happened at the beginning of the coup was that the Air Force, the U.S. Air Force at the Incirlik Air Force Base, these are the planes that go off to bomb Syria, to bomb Iraq, etc., they were locked down. They weren't allowed to fly during that period. So it raises some interesting questions about what might be a diminishing role for the U.S. militarily in Turkey, and it also raises the question of what will happen to Turkey's role in NATO. Turkey right now has the largest on-the-ground military force in of any European country in NATO, 500,000 troops under arms. And if, as is anticipated, the Turkish government makes a move to reinstate the death penalty and therefore is essentially summarily ending its effort to join the European Union, it raises the question of whether they will also be asked to leave NATO. There's some very uncertain questions about what the role of Turkey is going to be in this next period. I think one of the realities that we have to look at is that right now, one of the two candidates, Donald Trump, does not have any knowledge about Turkey, has no one on his staff, his very small staff other than his family, apparently, that knows anything about Turkey. So he's in no position to have any information about even how to think about it. Hillary Clinton, who has been so involved in the militarization of U.S. foreign policy over the last 15 years or more, has all the access that she would need to information about Turkey, but it's not at all clear what her posture would be, whether she would continue to see Turkey as a key ally solely because she wants a place from which to project U.S. military power in the region, or whether there might be a different view of Turkey after this coup attempt and with this incredible crackdown, the clamping down on human rights activists, on journalists. Human rights are being really trampled in Turkey right now. So it's very hard to know, to speak of what the U.S. response might be, because right now we still don't know exactly what's going on inside Turkey.
This is David D, and I have a question for either one of you, Medea or I was going to call you Colonel. Just Anne or our guest on the phone. Under George Bush, we really saw the manifestation of AFRICOM. And we saw it increase with Obama. We saw Libya get attacked and there was overthrow. And oftentimes when we talk about foreign policy, it centers on the Middle East and obvious, you know, for obvious reasons. But we don't really get into the nuts and bolts of what is going on in the continent, what is going to be going on in South America. Especially with a Trump administration, what can those continents have to, you know, what do they need to deal with? Or what do you anticipate them having to deal with if he gets into office?
Well, certainly the issue of Africa, where now the United States has a unified command, a unified military command, meaning all military services have representatives at a senior military headquarters, which is in Stuttgart, Germany, along with the European command. And I think both Medea and I have been to Stuttgart, and we've been outside the gates of it, and both of us have protested out there. I myself served in Africa as a U.S. diplomat, and I can tell you that the scope of military operations in training missions, even back when I was in like the middle 1990s. We had military exercises, training exercises going in many, many of the African countries. And now under AFRICOM, it has just exploded. And in places like Mali and places like Chad and places like Nigeria and Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana, Sierra Leone, Guinea, all of these places have a continuing U.S. military presence. It may be a turnover of military training teams, but the reach of the United States military now in Africa is the highest it's ever been, and some of the particular weapon systems that we have, particularly drones, which Medea has written so much about, that's one of the weapon systems that the United States has in Africa.
Maybe I could address a little the Latin America issue. I just came back from Honduras last week, where we're giving $18 million of military, quote, aid to this very repressive military and police forces, and doing all kinds of training of the police forces that have been responsible for a lot of human rights abuses there. I spent time with the family of Berta Cáceres, the environmental hero who was gunned down, and she herself called out Hillary Clinton after the coup as saying Hillary Clinton being involved in supporting the government that came in after the coup. We stopped at the Palmarola Air Force Base, which the U.S. says is not a U.S. base. It says it's a Honduran base, but it's been there since the 1980s. So Hondurans laugh when they say it's not a U.S. base. And Hondurans say there's eight other U.S. military installations in this very small country. And we were part of a trying to protect people who had just been raided by the police. When we went to the police station, who did we find but U.S. Trainers who were there and hid from us with their dark glasses as soon as we came in. But people say that the U.S. is all over Honduras and Central America in terms of the military and the police force. And then let's recognize that Latin America is going through a really tough time with efforts by the right wing in Latin America to overthrow the progressive governments from Brazil to certainly Venezuela, and changes already in Argentina. So there's a lot of political turmoil, and people are very concerned about, no matter who is the next president, thinking that the U.S. is going to turn back to Latin America and get more involved militarily.
If I may,
I would just add two quick points, if I may. One, on the question of Africa, I think what Anne said I think is very important. It's also true that the recent wars that have been waged in North Africa and the Middle East, particularly the war that Hillary Clinton was so instrumental in getting U.S. involvement in Libya, led to, more than anything else, the massive expansion of arms trade throughout the country. What happened in Libya with the overthrow of the Gaddafi government was that people threw open the holding pieces of massive amounts of weapons that had been amassed over the years, and those weapons are now being seen everywhere across Central Africa, in North Africa. The conflict in Mali 2 years ago involved Libyan weapons. They're also moving east into the Middle East. So the impact, the aftermath of the Libya war is still very much being felt. The only other point I think that's important here is that it's one of the challenges when we hear a question like, what would policy towards Africa be under a Trump administration? I don't think anybody can say. Trump has never talked about what a policy would look like. We know that he's not as in favor of the so-called free trade model for that goes to AGOA, for instance, the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act in Congress. But would he actually do anything different? Would he demilitarize the current completely militarized U.S. policy towards Africa? I don't see any evidence of that. But we don't have evidence of anything. We don't have a clue what Trump would actually try to do in Africa.
I'd like to ask Colonel Wright something that has been nagging me, and I'm certainly not trying to ask this question because I want to in any way exonerate the war hawk, Secretary Clinton. But with regard to the emails, those damned emails, the secrets that are in those emails, it's not going to be June 6, 1942, at Omaha Beach, the troops are going to land, and it's going to be D-Day. It's not going to have a list of all of the American assets in foreign countries. It's like, well, we don't think the president of that country, he's a jerk, in my opinion, some ambassador, some diplomat might write. But those secrets are not germane to national security, are they? The secrets that would be exchanged that she's accused of having exposed?
We're going to have to get to that in a moment, Askia. Right now, we have one of the big speakers tonight for the Republican Party, and that is former Republican presidential candidate Marco Rubio.
She turned her back on the fallen heroes in Benghazi, carelessly jeopardized our national security, and then she lied about it to the American people. Hillary Clinton does not have the honesty, the courage, or the independence to be the president we need for the next 4 years after the president we've had for the past eight. But unlike Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump is committed to cut taxes, curb spending, and get our national debt under control. Unlike Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump takes seriously the threats from Islamic radicals and is committed to rebuilding our military. And unlike Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, he has committed to appointing constitutionalist judges who will respect the proper role of the judiciary. After a long and spirited primary, the time for fighting each other is over. It's time to come together and fight for a new direction for America. It's time to win in November.
Please welcome United States Senator Ted Cruz of Texas.
And this is Republican Senator Ted Cruz. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's live broadcast of the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio.
Each and every one of you. Heidi and I are so honored to join you here in Cleveland, where LeBron James just led an incredible comeback victory. And I am convinced America is going to come back too. I want to congratulate Donald Trump on winning the nomination last night. And like each of you, I want to see the principles that our party believes prevail in November. Conventions are times of excitement, but given the events of the last few weeks, I hope you'll allow me a moment to talk to you about what's really at stake. Just 2 weeks ago, a 9-year-old girl named Caroline was having a carefree Texas summer, swimming in the pool, playing with friends, doing all the things a happy child might do. Like most children, she relied upon the love that she received from her mom, Heidi, and her dad, a police sergeant named Michael Smith. That is, until he became one of the 5 police officers gunned down in Dallas. The day her father was murdered, Caroline gave him a hug and a kiss as he left for work. But as they parted, her dad asked her something he hadn't asked before. What if this is the last time you ever kiss or hug me? Later, as she thought of her fallen father and that last heartbreaking hug, Caroline broke down into tears. How could anything ever be okay again? Michael Smith was a former Army Ranger who spent 3 decades with the Dallas Police Department. I have no idea who he voted for in the last election or what he thought about this one, but his life was a testament to devotion. He protected the very protesters who mocked him because he loved his country and his fellow man. His work gave new meaning to that line from literature, "To die of love is to live by it." As I thought about what I wanted to say tonight, Michael Smith's story weighed on my heart. Maybe that's because his daughter, Caroline, is about the same age as my eldest daughter and happens to share the same name. Maybe it's because I saw a video of that dear, sweet child choking back sobs as she remembered her daddy's last question to her. Maybe it's because we live in a world where so many others have had their lives destroyed by evil in places like Orlando and Paris and Nice and Baton Rouge. Maybe it's because of the simple question itself. What if this, right now, is our last time? Our last moment to do something for our families and our country? Did we live up to the values we say we believe? Did we do all we really could? That's really what elections should be about. That's why you and millions like you devoted so much time and sacrifice to this campaign. We're fighting not for one particular candidate or one campaign, but because each of us wants to be able to tell our kids and grandkids, our own Carolines, that we did our best for their future and our country. America is more than just a landmass between two oceans. America is an ideal, a simple yet powerful idea. Freedom matters. For much of human history, government power has been the unavoidable constant in life. Government decrees, and the people obey. But not here. We have no king or queen. We have no dictator. We, the people, constrain government. Our nation is exceptional because it was built on the five most beautiful and powerful words in the English language. I want to be free. Never has that message been more needed than today. We stand here tonight, a nation divided. Partisan rancor, anger, even hatred are tearing America apart. And citizens are furious, rightly furious, at a political establishment that cynically breaks its promises and that ignores the will of the people. We have to do better. We owe our fallen heroes more than that. Now, of course, Obama and Clinton will also tell you that they care about our children's future. And I want to believe them. But there is a profound difference in our two parties' vision for the future. Theirs is the party that thinks ISIS is a JV team, that responds to the death of Americans at Benghazi by asking, what difference does it make? And that thinks it's possible to make a deal with Iran, which celebrates as holidays Death to America Day and Death to Israel Day. My friends, this is madness. President Obama is a man who does everything backwards. He wants to close Guantanamo Bay and open up our borders. He exports jobs and imports terrorists. Enough is enough. And I am here to tell you there is a better vision for our future, a return to freedom. On education, your freedom to choose your child's education, even if you aren't as rich as Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. On health care, your freedom to choose your own doctor without Obamacare. On taxes, your freedom to provide for your family without the IRS beating down your door. The internet, keep it free from taxes, free from regulation, and don't give it away to Russia and China. Freedom means free speech, not politically correct safe spaces. Freedom means religious freedom, whether you are Christian or Jew, Muslim or atheist. Whether you are gay or straight, the Bill of Rights protects the rights of all of us to live according to our conscience. Freedom means the right to keep and bear arms and to protect your family. Freedom means that every human life is precious and must be protected. Freedom means Supreme Court justices who don't dictate policy, but instead follow the Constitution. And freedom means recognizing that our Constitution allows states to choose policies that reflect local values. Colorado might decide something different than Texas. New York, different than Iowa. That's the way it's supposed to be. Diversity. If not, what's the point of having states to begin with? Now, Hillary Clinton believes that government should make virtually every choice in your life. Education, health care, marriage, speech, all dictated out of Washington. But something powerful is happening. We've seen it in both parties. We've seen it in the United Kingdom's unprecedented Brexit vote to leave the European Union. Voters are overwhelmingly rejecting the political establishment and overwhelmingly rejecting big government. That is a profound victory, and it is one earned by each and every one of you. People are fed up with politicians who don't listen to them, fed up with a corrupt system that benefits the elites instead of working men and women. We deserve an immigration system that puts America first and, yes, builds a wall to keep America safe. A government that stops admitting ISIS terrorists as refugees. We deserve trade policies that put the interest of American farmers and manufacturing jobs over the global interests that are funding the lobbyists. And if we stand together and choose freedom, our future will be brighter. Freedom will bring back jobs and raise wages. Freedom will lift people out of dependency to the dignity of work. We can do this. 47 years ago to this day, America put the very first man on the moon. That was the power of freedom. Our party, the Republican Party, was founded to defeat slavery. Abraham Lincoln, the first Republican president, signed the Emancipation Proclamation. Together, we passed the Civil Rights Act, and together, we fought to eliminate Jim Crow laws. That's our collective legacy, although the media will never share it with you. Those were fights for freedom, and so is this. Sergeant Michael Smith stood up to protect our freedom. So do the soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines every day fighting radical Islamic terrorism. Of Alton Sterling.
We're having difficulty with the stream from the floor of the Republican Convention. Again, you are listening to Pacifica Radio's live coverage of the Republican National Convention. I'm Mitch Jezrich. I'm here with Medea Benjamin and Davey D. and Ann Wright. Skia Muhammad joining us also on the telephone is Phyllis Bennis. Anyone want to comment on what we've heard so far?
First, can we get the question about the secrets emails? Do they, if they're compromised, and there is no evidence that they were even compromised, would it imperil the national security of the United States?
Well, certainly, you know, the whole issue of this classification of documents in the U.S. government is a very important one. There is an overclassification of documents. I mean, unless a document is classified at least secret or above, nobody in the government will ever read it. So there are, it's a huge volume of materials that are out there that are classified. For a Secretary of State to decide that she or her communications people want to be able to kind of circumvent the security regime that is supposed to be in place for protecting all of those, I mean, that's where the fault is. Now, the specifics on what are in those documents, I mean, it's coming out here and there. But the bottom line is none of these senior officials ought to be doing that. She's one of many that have been doing it, and she should be, I mean, if you let the Secretary of State, you let the Director of the CIA, you let the Director of, the Secretary of Defense, if they get to use their own private servers, unclassified, then every Tom, Dick, and Harry is going to be doing it. Although on one level, that's not too bad, because that little Tom, Dick, and Harry is the one now we call Chelsea Manning. And we have found out a lot of things from the government through that, according to the government, the misuse of classified materials.
Just to jump in real quick, we were having trouble again with our feed, but Ted Cruz has endorsed Donald Trump, so many people were wondering if he was actually going to do that in that speech tonight. So I just want to let our folks know that. Medea, do you have any thoughts? We're here in our final few minutes of the hour.
Oh, my God, what a disgusting speech. I mean, this whole idea that he's going to tear up a nuclear deal with Iran, that they don't even talk about Benghazi. I mean, the Libya and his support for the overthrow of the Gaddafi regime and what's resulted in that, it's as if the people's lives in the Middle East that we have been destroying don't count at all. And I think his idea that we are letting in ISIS refugees, the last I looked, it's really hard to get a refugee status in the United States. And for him to act as if the Obama administration is letting in ISIS recruits or fighters is absolutely ridiculous.
Phyllis Bennis, yep, I'm going to get you in. Phyllis Bennis?
It's really a crucial point on this issue that Medea just raised about ISIS, admitting ISIS terrorists as refugees. The crime is that the United States has brought in, so far, less than 5,000 refugees in total. The number that were reaching Germany in an hour last summer. We have taken in less than 5,000. Germany had 800,000 just last year. So the real crime is refusing to allow in significant number of refugees in desperate need. The people who have carried out horrific attacks here, some of whom have said that they were somehow inspired by ISIS, none of them, not one, has been admitted as a refugee or came as a refugee. So it's creating these myths that are then welcomed with this enormous ovation. And you hear this guttural USA, USA behind it that just gets people so worked up with this call for states' rights, cutting government power, supporting the police. It is very much like what we've been hearing was anticipated, that this is a convention that's aimed at reprising the Nixon administration's campaign of 1968. It's about law and order. It's about reclaiming the U.S. for, quote, us. You know, we never talk about making America great, making America greater. We hear about making America great again, going back. It's looking backward to the time when white people, Christian people, were the unquestioned, not only majority, but the unquestioned dominant majority who had the right to make decisions, to have the power, economic power, political power, etc. And all that has come since then, the changing demographics of our country, the fact that we are rapidly becoming a majority-minority country, and several states already are.
And Phyllis, we are going to have to break in right there, because we do have to take a break, and I do apologize about that. But I do thank you very much. Anne Wright, I thank you very much. And Medea Benjamin, I thank you as well.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, guys.
We'll be back.
A few huge corporations now dominate the media landscape in America. As ownership gets more and more concentrated, fewer and fewer independent sources of information have survived in the marketplace. And those few significant alternatives that do survive, such as PBS and NPR, are under growing financial and political pressure to reduce critical news content and to shift their focus in a mainstream direction, which means being more attentive to establishment views than to the bleak realities of powerlessness that shape the lives of ordinary people.
You are listening to live coverage of the Republican National Convention from Pacifica Radio Network. Community Radio brings you the whole story from inside the Cleveland Convention Hall to the streets outside where ordinary people come to be heard. If you like this kind of coverage, please support your local community radio station. In a moment, we will return to live Pacifica coverage with hosts Mitch Jeserich and Askia Muhammad.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
The responsibility of putting together this material is fully mine. I did it as honestly as I could.
Thursday, July 21st at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, as part of the Real Cool Film Series, KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of The Connection.
Do you realize that hardly a day goes by without some item in the daily press concerning narcotics?
In 1962, a movie called The Connection opened in New York, then closed after two showings. However, the soundtrack was released, and jazz fans collected the album of this mysterious movie.
But imagine anyone wanting to use real junkies just to make a movie. Wow.
Again, that's The Connection, Thursday, July 21st at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You that build all the barns, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind desks, I just want you to know I can see through your mouth.
This is Pacifica Radio's live broadcast of the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio. I'm Mitch Jeserich with Askia Muhammad and Davey D. Also joining us now is Caroline Casey, the visionary activist. Caroline, good to have you here.
Woof.